Today's Teisho is Case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Linji's True Person. Introduction: taking a thief for one's son, taking a servant for the master. Can a broken ladle, a broken wooden ladle, be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Linji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank, always going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look. Then a monk came forward and said, what is this true person of no rank? Linji got down from the seat, grabbed and held him. The monk hesitated. Linji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. Okay. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back the 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand can't be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring, if it suddenly burst forth, it would flow freely. I want to thank everybody for doing such a good job, for sitting so deeply. And now this is one of the more famous koans, especially in our tradition, which is Linji Chan, Rinzai Zen. This is the famous teaching of the person of no rank. So just a little background, China was like America today, rather hierarchical place. So, if you passed your imperial exams, you got to be a mandarin. The word mandarin comes from Chinese culture. And that meant you were basically an administrator in the imperial government. And your fortune was made if this happened to you, not only your fortune, but the fortune of your whole family. Because if somebody in your family was an administrator, all of these privileges and contracts would flow into your family's coffers. And now, when we look at China, we say, oh, fortunately, it's not like that here. But of course, we know it is like that here, right? I mean, we have a similar problem. So, China had a steeply hierarchical society. And the Mandarin were less than 1% of the country. They were like 0.1%. And they were highly literate and very well trained. And then there were local leaders, and then there were peasants, right? And that was like 90% of the population, just toiling away. So, in China, most people were illiterate. And, if you were a Mandarin, you felt vastly superior to everybody else. And ordinary people felt vastly inferior to people at the top. And people at the top got to wear, beautiful clothes, not so different from now. And different people had different insignia on their different colored robes and different insignia on their robes. So if you were a government bureaucrat of a certain rank, you might have a dragon emblem. If you were at a different rank, you might have other creatures, right? Other mythical creatures. You might have a griffin, something like that. And so everybody had a rank. So Linji came along and said, actually, there is a person inside you, there's a person who has no rank, who's free from high and low, you know, free from those distinctions. And even if you can't read, right, you have this person of no rank inside of you. You may remember that in Zen history, Wei Nang, the great Zen master Wei Nang, was supposed to be illiterate, which again, in a Confucian society that valued literacy as the path to the top, you know, to say this man is illiterate was to say he belongs at the lowest level of society, he's contemptible and so on. But actually he was deeply enlightened. So anyway, you know, Lin Ji's person of no rank, this teaching of the person of no rank was really hugely well received by people in China. And Lin Ji Zen eventually became the dominant form of Buddhism in China, that in Pure Land. So like in the 19th century, if you went to most Zen temples in China and said, what kind of a temple? They would have all said, this is a Lin Ji temple. And this idea that everybody has Buddha nature was really revolutionary. And this koan is talking about that. But there's a lot more to the koan than this. You know, human beings have a big problem, right? And that is that we are imitators. You know, we are imitators. From the time we grow up, little children, you know, we learn how to be by watching other people. You know, so you know, I remember when I went to school I think it was kindergarten, you know. I had a lunchbox, which was an old lunchbox that my grandfather had owned, and it was an old metal, green metal lunchbox. And my mother had picked it up probably on my grandfather's farm in upstate New York and brought it back for me. And I took it to class, and it didn't look like anybody else's lunchbox. You know, all the other kids had lunchboxes that had television shows on them, on the lid. So, you know, basically there was like Roy Rogers and Dale Evans lunchbox and so on. And I had this lunchbox that looked like a foreign object, like it had come from another planet. And when I would take the lunchbox to school and I would look around at all the other kids, some of them, I must admit, this was in Baltimore, just had brown bag lunches, right? So they had brown bags and their mothers had put a sandwich in there wrapped in wax paper, something called wax paper that you may not know about. But I, you know, a lot of the kids had these lunch boxes. So, you know, I was anguished that I was a standout in the class, that I had this old, heavy, strange-looking lunchbox. And it would bother me, you know, it actually bothered me. And I would lie awake at night and think, you know, those kids are thinking less of me because of my lunchbox. And so I finally nagged my mother to get me a new lunchbox. And my mother grew up in the Great Depression in upstate New York, and, you know, basically having lunch was a good idea. You know, so my father grew up in this area during the Great Depression, right? My father grew up in New York City and Newark, but my mother grew up in upstate New York, and my grandparents basically during the Great Depression had like a farm in upstate New York. And my mother, you know, basically thought, you know, having a lunch was good enough and having a lunchbox was even better. And I just was agonizing over this old clunky lunchbox. So basically, I nagged and nagged and nagged my mother, and my mother finally bought me a Zorro lunchbox. I don't know if you know who Zorro is, but when I was growing up, Disney Studios, yes, there was a Disney Studios, you know, 50, 60 years ago. They had a television show on called Zorro. It was like a half-hour show. And there was this handsome guy who played Don Diego de la Vega, and he was secretly Zorro, and he had a cave where he kept his white horse and so on. Anyway, I was entranced with this show. It was so cool. And I was living in a row house in Baltimore, right, or an apartment complex in Baltimore. And, you know, this was like Mexico. It was this exotic land, and this hero who would go out and sword fight, you know, three men at once and so on. So I got my Zorro lunchbox, and it was like I finally felt like I was going to be accepted by all the other kids. And I was, you know, I remember going to class and just thinking, it was like yesterday I talked about my shirt, my Herman's Hermit's shirt. This was much earlier. This was my Zorro lunchbox. And so anyway, I came to school with my Zorro lunchbox, and I came into the classroom and I started walking to the coat room where we put all of our lunchboxes. And as I was walking along, I noticed all the kids were looking at me and they started laughing. And I looked down and there was like a trail of milk along the floor, right? And the thermos in the lunchbox had leaked milk, and it was leaking milk in, as I was walking along. It's funny, except for me, right? And for me, this was like traumatic. It's like, oh my gosh, they're laughing at me, right? Yeah, they're laughing, laughing at me. And I, you know, basically it took all the joy out of my Zorro lunchbox. I remember going home and crying, you know, the kids were laughing at me. So you know, this is, I think, not that uncommon, right? It's like, you know, we learn how to be people by looking to other people for approval. You know, we model ourselves on other people and we look to them for approval. Yeah, I remember in that same school, that was York Elementary School, and it's still there, York Elementary School in Baltimore. It's near Park Fairfax. Escapes me now. Lock Raven Boulevard. It's near Lock Raven Boulevard. So anyway, you know, basically, there was a kid there who was in the grade older than I was, Mike. And Mike was everything I wasn't. You know, he was handsome, he was athletic, and he used to wear like a leather jacket, like a kind of a, you know, leather jacket. Or a jacket that was a cool jacket. I don't know if it was leather. But, you know, Mike was like a year older than I am, and we would be out on the playground, and he was just everything I admired. You know, I was sort of dumpy little kid at the time. And Mike was this handsome, athletic, cool guy. And I actually went up to him and I said, "Would you be my friend?" And you know, I think I was thinking, I wasn't thinking it through, but I was saying, if you could only be my friend, you know, I would be a special person. I don't think I thought it through, but that was kind of where I was going with this. If you will be my friend, I will be a special person. And Mike was like a kid from Baltimore, and he said, "Well, I'll be your friend, but what are you going to give me? What are you going to give me?" And I thought, well, what, you know, I started giving him things that I had, you know, so I gave him some lunch money once. And then, you know, I would bring things to school that I could give to Mike so he would be my friend. And my grandfather had given me a jackknife that had a little crest on it, you know. And I took it to school as one of the things that I could give Mike. I took him some other stuff too, you know. So this is like a good deal for Mike. He was like getting like a steady stream of things from this kid. this dumb kid. And I gave Mike my jackknife. And then my mother was going through my things the way mothers do, you know, so infuriating, right? And she said, "Where is your jackknife?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know." And she knew that I valued that jackknife really highly. So finally she got it out of me that I had, "You're what? You know, what? You're giving this kid," you know. So my mother actually went to school, which was so humiliating. And this kid got called into the, you know, into the principal's office and had to give back all these things to me, right? He was shaking me down, basically. And, you know, that was one episode, but you know, it doesn't stop with experiences like that. You know, we go through our whole lives looking to others for ratification, you know, approval. And this is like a basic human impulse. You know, as we're growing up, we're trying to be a self, and we don't know how to be a self. And we're learning from other people how to be a self, right? And, you know, we're doing what they, it's like a transactional model. Like, we're doing what they will, we're going to bring them our treasures so they will like us, right? You know? And if we keep bringing them what they want, they will be our friend, right? This is so basic human. I think maybe I'm an odd man out. But I think this, if you look at human behavior, there's a lot of truth to this, right? You know, so you know, humans, because there is really no essential self, right? You know, humans are constantly looking to other people thinking they have a self. That's what they think, right? So I think when we look inside of ourselves, actually there's not much there. You know, so you know, even I certainly didn't introspect as a little kid, right? You know, I was mostly watching Zorro on TV. But you know, I think we know, you know, when we look inside, so to speak, there really isn't an inside. But I think we know, it's like a secret. We know that there's nobody there, you know. So because there's nobody there, we sort of look to others for models. So I wanted to be like Mike, right? Or I wanted to be like somebody else. If somebody were just like me, I would be a person. I would be real to myself. And I think this dynamic just goes on and on through our lives. And, you know, eventually we have, like, conflicts. We have conflicts that come from, you know, wanting to be like Mike, but also wanting to be like somebody else, right? So at some point, I got really interested in puppet theater. I remember seeing on TV a show. You might have seen there was a show called Howdy Doody. Howdy Doody. You probably haven't. If you're younger than, much younger than I am, you don't remember this. But there used to be a show where there was a little puppet cowboy named Howdy Doody. And there was a man there who wore he was supposed to be an Indian. He had like a headband. And his name was Buffalo Bob. It was Howdy Doody and Buffalo Bob. And I would watch Howdy Doody and Buffalo Bob, and Howdy Doody would say, "Hi, Buffalo Bob," you know. And it was fascinating to me, you know. And so there were some other puppet shows on TV, and I thought puppets were the coolest thing in the world. And, you know, I would never miss Howdy Doody. I just thought that was just like magic, you know. And, you know, anyway, I begged my parents to get me a puppet. But this was Baltimore in the 1950s, maybe 1950s. You know, there were puppets. Where do you get puppets? You know, that was like... So I, you know, this is after the lunchbox. I said to my mother, I want a puppet. And she got me a hand puppet, but that's not what I want. I wanted a marionette. I didn't even know the word marionette, you know. But a hand puppet, that was nothing, right? I wanted to marry a puppet. So anyway, my parents didn't know what I was talking about, and they weren't going to get it to me. So I went to the store. My mother finally gave me some money and said, "Will you go look for a puppet? You know, go find a." So I went over to the store and I said, "Do you have any puppets?" You know, and I, "Puppet? What are you talking about?" You know, so I went over to the dolls, right? I went over to the dolls, and there was like a Ken doll, and it's sort of like a puppet, right? There's no strings, but so I remember feeling nervous and getting this doll and taking it up. And this was in Baltimore in the 1950s. I remember this woman looked down at me and I was buying a doll. And she actually commented to the woman on the next, she said, "This boy is buying a doll." It was like, oh my God, right? You know, this is like, and I remember burning with shame, right? But buying the doll and bringing it home. And this caused like incredible anxiety for my parents, right? Incredible anxiety for my parents. Because, you know, they were worried that I was going to turn out to be gay, right? So you know, basically, my father got me, for my birthday, he got me a football uniform. This was the Baltimore Colts. If you know anything, there was a guy named Johnny Unitas, who everybody had a football cards, and Johnny Unitas was the coolest person in Baltimore, and he was a football star. And my father got me a uniform with Johnny Unitas's number. So I was going to, and he said, you're a red-blooded American boy. You know, you're going to." So, you know, basically, I was starting to like imitate the wrong kinds of people. You know, so all of this is part of the dynamic of who we are. And I think if we start going through our own lives, please don't do it at Sesshin unless it's coming up and you're working with your koan. We begin to realize how often, you know, we've been acting from this place of deficit, right? It's like, I in order to be loved, I have to be like this, but I'm not. So I need to enter into transactions with people. I need to become like, you know, like the cool guy in school, or I need to be associated with the cool guy in school. You know, and as we grow up, this doesn't stop. It takes more and more sophisticated forms. But what it means is that we don't know how to be authentic. We don't know how to be real, you know. Or because, you know, actually when we stop imitating others, all we experience in ourselves is emptiness, right? Emptiness. And so, you know, basically we're all, you know, right now, if you look at our political situation, right, you see like the Republicans, you know, with all due respect, just seem to be utterly crazy. But actually what they're caught up in is like this dynamic of mutual imitation and mutual reinforcement, and they can't get out, right? And, you know, if you look at other places in the world, you see the same thing. There's just like this stunning uniformity. Everybody's absolutely the same, and they're really working hard to all be the same. And people are worried, you know, about not being the same. That's like a source of great anxiety. So you know, it's very difficult then for humans to just stop, to break this cycle, to break this cycle. But you know, the cycle itself causes us so much unhappiness. It causes us so much unhappiness. Because of course, we can never be Mike, you know, we can never be Mike. You know, we'll never, no matter what Kurt does, he'll never be Mike. Can't. And you know what? Mike is not Mike, right? See, Mike is imitating somebody else, maybe somebody from West Side Story in a movie he saw. You know, so this is the human dilemma, right? It's very difficult. And, you know, most people, when they're confronted with the falsity of their identity, they nervously look around again for people to ratify that identity, right? But there is a, you know, that's just going back into the cycle. You know, so I think Zen is something really, really remarkable, or Buddhism in general. You know, in Buddhism, we have this word samsara. And we understand nirvana here and samsara here, right? And nirvana is bliss and samsara is suffering. But actually the word samsara is significant, because the word means to go around and around in a circle. It means you keep repeating the same behavior over and over again. It's like samsara is produced by looking to others to be real. And then, of course, they're not real either, right? And so, you know, basically we're trapped in this cycle of imitation and envy and imitation. And we're all trying to be something that isn't real to begin with. You know, so I think that, meditation, you know, is really liberating, because it helps us to get off that burning wheel of imitation, right? And, you know, when we stop trying to imitate others and we start allowing ourselves to be in the moment, what we find is the self just disappears. And that's frightening. And that's the most frightening thing about meditation. You know, when people start doing meditation, they feel better. But at some point that starts happening. It's like the self starts to disappear. And they get nervous because they feel like they're slipping into emptiness, right? And that's terrifying. That means being no one, right? And so, you know, a lot of people start meditation. They're very enthusiastic about it. It makes them feel better until they begin to experience that emptiness. And then that's the most challenging thing about meditation, is, you know, staying with that emptiness long enough to realize that there's something there beyond the emptiness, right? It's just not like an empty void. You know, it's something there beyond that. It's like, at first it just seems like blankness, and that's terrifying. But then, you know, what happens is something really profound. You know, I said yesterday that the conscious mind is like a tip of an iceberg, right? It's like the tiniest part of our awareness. And underneath that conscious mind, there's this vast intelligence that's deeply connected to everything. See? And this is the person of no rank. This is Linji Rinzai's person of no rank. So when we live, you know, at the top of the iceberg, so to speak, you know, we're just caught in this dynamic of imitation and envy and fear, and imitation and envy and fear. But actually, when we stop, we sit down on the cushion and we enter Mushin, you know, at first it feels like the void, right? But eventually something really amazing happens, because we begin to feel this deep sense of connectedness to everything around us. And it's the self-referencing stops, right? This is very, very important. You know, self-referencing stops, and when the self-referencing stops, and we go into that emptiness, what we're really doing is going through the layers of the mind. And when we get to this blank mind, it's only blank when we look at it from the standpoint of the little mind. But actually, there's all this intelligence there, all this connectedness there. So like today is day 3 of Sesshin. And, you know, you may or may not have gone through this transition, but, you know, at the end, after lunch, you might go outside and you suddenly feel like everything is alive. Everything. This is why I meditate, you know. It's like I've been doing this since 1975, right? And I can't wait to get on the cushion. Because, you know, around day three of Sesshin, I go outside and it's like the whole world is my body. The whole world is myself. And I'm telling you the truth, right? So that experience, the whole world is alive. Everything, I'm connected to everything. This is like heaven. Will you please be my friend so I can be real? I'll give you my grandfather's pocket knife. You know, and that person was exploiting me, you know. But even if he were sincere, that's a false relationship. It's two emptinesses talking to each other, right? But when we go into deep Mushin and we enter the great mind, the big mind, you know, the whole world becomes our body. Everything becomes our rice. You just have to lean down and eat. You know, this is what it means to encounter the person of no rank. You know, so look, you know, we have a life. I'm Kurt. You know, I call myself Kurt. Every 2 weeks, the state of New Jersey cuts me a check. It's great. You know, I'm not going to give it to somebody else. I pick it up. You know, it's my check. But all the same, you know, Kurt is just like this, the tip of this iceberg. And, you know, when we spend a lot of time in Kurt consciousness, our world gets smaller and smaller. It just does. It gets smaller and smaller. And it's driven by like these, this a lot of the time by these neurotic compulsions, right? Trying to be liked. But you know, if you spend more time doing what we're doing, and it takes a while, you go into that emptiness and you think, oh man, when is he going to ring the bell? It's just emptiness. But actually, all, you know, your whole being is coming alive below the surface of your consciousness. And that sense of connectedness might not register till you go outside, but it's going to register, you know. And you know, this is living from the Buddhist standpoint, as a complete person, right? So yes, you know, that iceberg does have a tip, you know. It's Bill, it's Susan. That's part of the whole package too. But when we are cut off from the person of no rank, you know, our life becomes more and more repetitive and stale and empty. And when we go into so-called empty mind, you know, we begin to make contact with this deeper part of ourselves. And that connects, that's the part that connects us to the whole world. So, you know, so when I look outside at a tree, you know, outside of this room, there is a tree. And I think tree, you know, I'm not really making a deep connection, right? I'm just naming the tree. But, you know, I can walk outside and, you know, experience that tree as part of myself, which it is, and I'm part of that tree. You know, that's a much, much deeper connection than simply looking at it and giving it a name. It's an acuminata, you know. And, you know, so Rinzai is saying, look, you know, life is short. Life is short as Kurt, right? You know, so Kurt was born in 1955 and will die at some point, hope, maybe 2055, who knows, you know, maybe next week. But, you know, the Zen view, the Buddhist view, is that big mind has no birth and no death. So this is kind of like a radical proposition, right? That our consciousness has a beginning and an end, but our unconsciousness has no beginning and no end because it's not ours. You know, Kurt is a thought in the big mind. But the big mind was here long before Kurt and will be here long after Kurt. See, that's the view. That's the view. You don't have to accept it. But when you're in your big mind, you know, on day three or four of Sesshin, and you go outside and you feel that deep sense of connection, that deep sense of well-being, you know, you may have moments where you realize there's no birth and there's no death. Here, there is no birth and there is no death. You know, here, at the top of the iceberg, there's a birth and a death. But at the deeper part of the iceberg, there's no birth and there's no death. See, that's the view. So Rinzai is saying to all these people who are so unhappy, you know, so unhappy, you know, I could have been a contender. I don't know if you know that movie. I could have been a contender. I could have been a Mandarin, you know, but I failed my imperial exam. You know, my family spent all that money and now I'm just, you know, whatever. You know, I'm trading in used shoes or something, right? I've got some life like that, you know. And I think, oh, I could have been a contender. See? All these people eating their hearts out because they're not something. And yet, you know, their something is not, you know, really just as unhappy as whatever they're admiring is just as unhappy and empty as they feel, right? But there's this other possibility, right? To encounter the person of no rank, you know, that great mind in ourselves. Taking a thief for one's son, taking a servant for the master, that's ordinary consciousness, right? That's ordinary consciousness. You know, we can't tell the servant from the master. We can't tell the thief from our son. I was asking this guy, Mike, to like me, and he was shaking me down for my lunch money, right? I was so confused, right? Because I wanted to be real. And I thought he had the power to make me real. Can a broken ladle be your ancestor's skull? See, we don't know, you know, in English we have that wonderful saying, I don't know my ass from a hole in the ground, right? That's sort of where he's going here. We don't know our ass from a hole in the ground, right? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either, see? When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? How do you tell the true from the false? Right? And if you look to others for approval, that's the road to false. Lin Ji said to the assembly, there is a true person with no rank, always going in and out through the portals of your face, breathing in and breathing out, breathing in and breathing out. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look. Then a monk came forward and said, "What is the true person of no rank?" Notice what he's doing. He's asking Lin Ji to approve of him, right? It's like he's the smart student in the class. And he's looking to Lin Ji for the answer. And Lin Ji, you know, jumps down, and you know, Lin Ji is kind of direct. He jumps down from his seat, he grabs him and hells him. And the monk hesitated, and he pushes him away. And then he says, this true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. It's like, you know, you've traded gold for, you know, you're trading gold for scrap metal, you know. Quit looking to others for approval. Go deep into the mind and find the big mind there. Well, that's what we're all doing. And it's so beautiful to see everybody practicing so wholeheartedly. You know, deep sitting makes people not crude spirited. You know, you can't get to that big mind by meditating for 20 minutes every day. That's not how it's done. You know, nobody ever had a great awakening experience, you know, meditating 20 minutes a day. That's just, it's never going to happen. So, you know, you have to become intimate with your big mind, and that means doing just what you're doing here, coming to Sesshin and practicing the great way. So keep up the good work.